Good morning. The next matter on the calendar is the case of Deborah J. Palmer, surviving spouse and trustee for the heirs of Gary J. Palmer versus Walker Jamar Company and Honeywell International, Inc. Will there be some dividing of time by respondents?
Yes, Your Honor. We've agreed to divide time equally, 7.5 minutes each.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Layton will go first.
All right. Thank you. When you reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us and the recording, and you may take your time to adjust that podium to the height that is comfortable for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is David Thompson. I am pro hoc vice admitted counsel, and I was informed that I did not need to have a Minnesota counsel with me today, given that fact. Essentially, there are, as the court's aware, two summary judgment orders that are on appeal in this case, or in these consolidated cases. The first involves the circumstances of Honeywell Corporation or Honeywell International. Judge Guthman in the district court entered summary judgment on essentially three issues. Two were statute of limitations related. Judge Guthman applied what I will refer to as a single injury rule to bar Deborah Palmer's claims against Honeywell in this case. And Judge Guthman also applied that which I would characterize as a unidimensional application of the discovery rule to commence the running of the six-year limitations period in this matter. The third issue, as to Honeywell, is the matter of sufficient evidence as to exposure. In our estimation, the district court construed the factual record essentially against us and not in favor of us as a non-moving in a summary judgment setting.
Only on that last issue or on all of the issues?
On all of them. Particularly as to the exposure issues, the manner in which the court addressed the single injury rule following a unpublished district court decision in DiGilio is a matter of law, but also as a matter of with regard to the discovery rule, certainly we believe that the record was construed against us when there were genuine issues of material fact relative to the application of it. Obviously, we have to get to the point of the application of a discovery rule and past the single injury application. There is no Minnesota appellate court decision which commands application of the single injury rule as it was applied in this case. And that includes Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Dalton back in 1968, which predated the key decisions that I think dictate that a two injury rule, as is the rule in virtually all jurisdictions in this country, be applied, and that's in Cargiala and DeCasse. There was a recitation of language from Cargiala by the district court that was taken out of context, and it was repeated in the briefing by Honeywell. In Cargiala, though, the Eighth Circuit, and this is the first time, was it sort of an embryonic time dealing with the discovery rule generally, and this was an asbestos disease case specifically. The Eighth Circuit said in Cargiala, under Minnesota law, an instruction on the statute of limitations must be couched, and this is language that wasn't highlighted by the district court. Under Minnesota law, an instruction on the statute of limitations must be couched in terms of when damage has resulted from the alleged breach of duty. That is, the time when a claim could be brought in a court of law without dismissal for failure to state a claim. And that states a discovery rule, because one has to know who to sue and what the breach of duty is. That is, that implicates substantive liability. So it is when not just a disease is identified, but also when there is the reasonable, the objectively reasonable point of knowledge on the part of the plaintiff as to the breach of duty, the fault of the tortfeasor, and necessarily the identification of the product involved in
of
this product liability
product
setting.
Or of the defendant?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Of the product or of the individual defendant?
The product of the defendant, the conduct of the defendant. That's what Carjala says, and that's the, and Carjala is cited and quoted from in this respect in DeCasi. So it is a matter of not just I knew when I got an asbestos-related disease, but also the conduct and the identity of the defendant. The identity of the defendant and the product and the defective nature of the product. We cited in our briefing in the trial court and on appeal here the decision of the Eighth Circuit in Foster versus Johns Manville. Now, it's a discovery rule asbestos litigation case based on Iowa law. I acknowledge that. But as we state in our briefing, we start off with the proposition, and it's on 37 of our main brief. The Minnesota Supreme Court stated last year in Frederick versus Wallerick that in a discovery rule statute of limitations setting, it was a medical negligence case, that an analysis of when a claim accrues necessarily involves consideration of all elements of the claim. Not just one element of the claim, certainly is the illness, the injury. Other elements of the claim, however, are the defective nature of the product. So it is then when there is a coalescence of all of these elements as in terms of a reasonable point of discovery in a temporal sense that the limitations period here begins to run. In this case, the district court drew conclusions in a number of respects. And in addition to embracing the single injury rule, also stated that, made assumptions as to when the plaintiff or the decedent in this case would have had knowledge of a claim. So in this particular case, without the coalescence of all of those factors and without the district court recognizing that, I think part of it was that the district court was looking at the running of the statute, and I stated in a unidimensional analysis, looking at just the injury, not all of these other elements. And I think that assumption on the part of the court, the district court, dictated how the court looked at the summary judgment record. I'd like to call attention to the exposure evidence as to the Honeywell products.
Now you're talking about the sufficiency question.
Correct. I'm moving on to the exposure.
I just want to make sure I know where
yes.
you're going.
So I think that we were not granted the deference we should have been as the non-movement in a summary judgment setting by the district court, both as to the exposure evidence and as to the discovery rule running of the statute of limitations issues. The Bendix exposure is particularly strictly construed against us by the district court. The district court recognized, and I'm looking at page 27 of our reply brief, and we narrate there how we maintain the evidence should have been looked at from the perspective of asbestos exposure evidence and sufficiency of it.
He was working at an Oldsmobile dealership, and there was at least some evidence in the record that Oldsmobiles and like makes had the product in it.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court did properly recognize Bendix Corporation, Eugene Rogers, who was deposed back in 1984 and is
he's deceased now.
Long gone, absolutely. And he's the district court did properly recognize that, Mr. Rogers gained an undisputed knowledge of the brake products the company produced, whether the products contained asbestos, and whether the products whether they contained asbestos, and the entire manufacturing of it. I say, in our brief beginning at 27, the following facts may properly be drawn from a summary judgment appropriate reading of the Rogers testimony. And Mr. Rogers is referenced in a footnote to in a California Court of Appeals case from 2017, which narrates his expertise and his experience with the company. It's a reported decision, Phillips versus Honeywell. And that's in footnote 6 of our reply brief. The following facts may properly be drawn from a summary judgment appropriate reading of the Eugene Robert Rogers testimony. One, beginning in the late 50s, early 50s, early 60s, excuse me, Bendix sold both primary and secondary original equipment, OEM aftermarket, brake drum linings to General Motors Oldsmobile Division. Bendix Corporation had probably 100%, this is Rogers' testimony, of the Oldsmobile business during the 15, 20 years extending from the very late 50s, early 60s. In addition, that brings us way into the 70s. The record was construed against us in that
one
respect.
One would presume that the vehicles that are being brought in for service aren't the brand new ones.
Correct. And he also testified that the aftermarket product, they also supplied 100% of the aftermarkets.
Time is running short.
And I understand.
And I'd like to have you turn to the Walker-Jamar claim.
Sure.
First of all, just turn it over to you on the Walker-Jamar claim, and then I may
have
some questions.
Last time I was in front of the Minnesota Court of Appeals was 25 years ago. In the Everett case, Mr. Layton and I were both here. We look a little different now.
None of us was here.
We were children.
That makes us feel even older. I'll say this. We narrate the facts here. Essentially, what was going on in 1985, Johns Manville had filed a bankruptcy based on asbestos liabilities in 1982. Walker-Jamar had just been sued for the first time in an asbestos product liability case the year before in 1984. So we have this dissolution process and a cover story that we narrate in our brief. I won't get into it. At this point, Minnesota trial courts from the late 80s into until 2003, and I had nothing to do with the Podvan case. That was another case, and I'll address that. But the point is that if you look at DeCasse and the analysis of a continuing tort, these liabilities, mesothelioma has an average latency time from the time of first exposure of 36.7 years. Now, so you had exposures to Walker-Jamar products, 50s, 60s, 70s. Then you had disease taking place up to 50 or more years later. Now, there's narration in our brief about the role of the insurance companies. They were paying on the risk consistently after dissolution. And Mr. Layton would litigate the issue of dissolution in front of a number of district judges in Hennepin and Ramsey counties and over the years, and it was unsuccessful.
Pre-Podvan.
Excuse me?
You're talking about litigate that issue.
Post-85, right up until 2003.
Right, pre-Podvan.
Pre-Podvan, I'm sorry, I didn't hear. So basically the deal is that you had insurance coverage paying for this liability. You had a provision for this liability that was recognized by everyone. In North Dakota, more recently, after the 2007 amendment enactment of Section 5 of Minnesota Statute 3028.781. In that instance, you had a recognition of the fact that you can't do this. Our position is it's, number one, an expression of policy. In Podvan, the Court of Appeals was simply inferring legislative intent. Now we know what it is. Now, I don't think that's a retroactive application of the statute. But alternatively and consecutively, our position is that the 2007 enactment of subdivision 5 is also applicable here prospectively. This claim did not accrue until well after the effective date of the 2007 amendment. Our position is that it should apply to this case. The legislature can also revive extinguished claims, and that's the 35W Bridge litigation addressed that in a case that I know you're all familiar with. My time's expired, Your Honor.
Just one moment. Question.
Time is short. You've talked about Podvan. It seems to me that if we're going to reverse the district court on that issue, we would have to publish an opinion, and I would like you either now or on rebuttal to tell me what our syllabus point would be to reverse the district court in light of Podvan.
I think the most salient point, and I'll make it very quickly, is the expression of legislative policy in the 2007 amendment that takes it out of the realm of inference. The linchpin of Podvan is where the Court of Appeals says, we infer that the legislature's intention was XYZ. We know that that is not the case. So number one, we believe that that statutory enactment can be used to help interpret legislative policy as to what it was back then, and Podvan was proceeding in a vacuum at that time.
I'm going to stop you because you can catch up and return to that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for Barker Jamar.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, Richard Layton on behalf of respondent Walker Jamar Company. I believe in order to get to where the appellant wants to go in this, this court essentially has to overrule and vacate Podvan. Appellant wants to turn jurisprudence on its head by saying all these lower court decisions that preceded Podvan are cases that state the proper rule, and that this court in the Podvan case misstated the rule or didn't understand, rendered an improper interpretation of the corporate dissolution statute. We think that Podvan properly interpreted the statute. The statute at the time and in the Podvan case, the claims were based on an exception to the bar of claims set forth in the statute for liabilities incurred during dissolution proceedings. All the district courts prior to that time had adopted the interpretation that the plaintiff's counsel wanted, which was liabilities incurred means, liabilities that are, that may be in the process of accruing before, during, and after dissolution. Podvan recognized that the cause of action did not accrue, the liability could not accrue, at least until the disease had manifested, and that was when the damages would occur. In Podvan, it was in 2001, well after the corporate dissolution of Jamar, no liabilities were incurred at the time of Jamar's dissolution because the court interpreted liabilities incurred could not refer to unmatured claims. That's the standard of Podvan, and in order to get to where the appellant wants you to go, you have to say that doesn't apply.
In Podvan, we reversed one of the district courts that was applying the rule.
Correct.
Advanced here.
Correct. The argument that the 2007 amendment states the legislative intent to reverse Podvan is is misplaced for several reasons. Number one, in order to retroactively apply a statute, Section 645.21 states that there is a presumption against such retroactive application. Minnesota case law is legion with cases that uphold that presumption against retroactivity. The case law is well established that in order for any statute or amendment to be retroactively applied, there has to be clear, manifest, and unequivocally expressed intent by the legislature. With respect to the 2007 amendment, there is no such intent. The statute simply states it is effective July 1st, 2007. That's all. The amendment adds another exception to the bar of claims against dissolved corporations. But in order to retroactively apply that to a corporation that dissolved 22 years earlier, there's got to be something more than this statute takes effect on July 1st, 2007. As far as the revival of claims, in fact, there was an amendment just the year before 2007 to the corporate dissolution statute to add an exception for statutory homeowner warranty claims. When the legislature passed that amendment, they expressly stated, this amendment applies to actions pending on or commenced on or after the day following enactment. 2007 comes along, the legislature adds that amendment, no such language. Another way of reviving claims or retroactively applying an amendment is through clarification. Clarification isn't, you know, just because the legislature says this is a clarification, it doesn't necessarily make it retroactive, but there seems to be a presumption in the case law that that is something that needs to be addressed. Once again, there still has to be a clear expression of legislative intent to clarify. That wasn't the case with the 2007 amendment. In fact, in Podvin, I tried to argue that in a 1991 amendment, changing the language about liabilities incurred to liabilities incurred during the winding up of the corporate affairs, which would, you know, change the meaning and apply it more to what the court ended up ruling, should apply to Jamar's dissolution in 1985, because there was language in the preface to that amendment that said, you know, and it was a group of amendments to various statutes in the course of the 1991 amendment, but they said these amendments clarify and modify the statutes. And the Court of Appeals in Podvin says, well, it does say clarify, but it also says modify. So for us, it's not clear enough. Here, we have nothing. Nothing about clarifying, modifying, or anything. As far as the timing, sometimes clarification can be inferred from the timing of the amendment. If it follows shortly after a case that goes contrary to the legislative intent, the legislature can come back the next session and say, well, that's not what we meant, and we're going to clarify this statute and say what we meant. That happened in the Hoban case. There was a prior case, and that the court ruled and the legislature said, well, that's not what we meant. So the next session, 7 months later, they enacted an amendment to the statute. And because of the timing, that's inferred to reverse the claim. Same thing in Carlson versus Lilliard. That was 4 months after the court ruling. The legislature passed an amendment to clarify its intent. I want to conclude with one final argument about the whole impact of corporate dissolution and the whole effect. Under the Camacho case, Minnesota Supreme Court case in 2005, the court stated that the Corporate Dissolution Act is a statute of repose. At common law, when a corporation dissolved, all claims against the corporation abated. The corporate dissolution statute is a statutory extension of that time for a definite point in time to give a grace period to allow people to, individuals, whatever, to assert claims against the corporation. Because the claims against a dissolved corporation are purely statutory and in derogation of common law, the courts must strictly construe the Corporate Dissolution Act's requirements. For these reasons, I respectfully request the court to affirm the district court's order granting Walker Jamar's motion to dismiss for insufficiency of service of process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford with Bassford Remley, representing the respondent, Honeywell International. I've only got 7.5 minutes, so I can't cover all 3 points that were made today. I'm certainly not going to cover the single indivisible injury rule because, as we pointed out in our brief, it's inconsequential in this case because both the diagnosis of mesothelioma and the diagnosis of asbestos-related calcium deposits occurred more than 6 years before Ms. Palmer filed this action against Honeywell. So I'm going to focus my comments really on the statute of limitations and the proper accrual of the cause of action. And we're asking this court to affirm the district court in that regard because it is undisputed, and the facts are undisputed with respect to this issue, that Mr. Palmer was diagnosed with an asbestos-related disease, and he was specifically told and understood that that disease was caused by asbestos more than 6 years before he sued Honeywell. That's at transcript page 55 where that acknowledgement is made. That's also in Mr. Palmer's preservation deposition at pages 43 and 44, and it's a point that's conceded in the response brief. So my friend's position before this court today is dependent on the court interpreting Minnesota's accrual rule to not only require a physical manifestation of an injury and knowledge of the cause of that injury, but also the identity of the specific defendant and that defendant's legal liability before a cause of action accrues. That is not the law in this state, nor has it ever been the law in this state. One of your honors asked about a syllabus point, and if you do publish this case, my syllabus point would be this. A cause of action accrues when an injury manifests itself, and there is knowledge by the plaintiff of a causal relationship between exposure to a toxin and that injury. That syllabus point is consistent with Dalton, and I would refer the court specifically to the last line of the decision, which is the key portion of the decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1968, where the court says, quote, "The facts are conclusive that plaintiff's condition, that is his disease, was known on August 27, 1957. That's when his doctor told him he had this condition. And the reason, therefore, was known not later than November 5th, 1957. And that is when he had an expert tell him, a medical professional tell him, that his condition was caused by exposure to the toxin. There is no discussion in Dalton or any Minnesota precedent that the plaintiff also needs to know with specificity what the precise identification of the defendant was. All of the cases address the product. In Philippek, which is, pardon me, Ron.
It seems like the source of the toxin in Dow Chemical was maybe the facts in that case were a little more specific as to where the toxin came from than they are here.
Right, but it's not only where the toxin came from. If I understand my friend's argument, it's that the plaintiff also needs to know what the defendant's act or omission was that gives rise to legal liability. And there are reasons why that is not the law in Minnesota. And I can give the court at least three, which is, well, number one, that information typically comes by way of an expert. And this is something that the district court pointed out. If the plaintiff's subjective awareness of the legal liability were the standard, the cause of action wouldn't accrue until litigation was well underway. Number two, that information, unlike a medical diagnosis, typically comes from a lawyer or an expert. So imagine a situation where you're sitting in a deposition and you say, Mr. Smith, how did you become aware of the defendant's act or omission, legal liability? If that information was conveyed by a lawyer, that would be subject to the attorney-client privilege. And that's a very real concern, because that's what happened in this case. On transcript page 55 of the hearing below, there was an acknowledgement that the legal liability, Honeywell's alleged legal liability, was conveyed by the attorney to the client. It's not something that the client came up with on his own. And imagine this, and as an additional reason why this isn't the law, imagine this. What defendant in their right mind would ever move for summary judgment on the statute of limitations if they have to show that the plaintiff knew or should have known of our particular liability more than 6 years ago, while maintaining a straight face later in the case and saying, we're not liable? That is why the only conditions, and it's important to recall that this accrual rule is itself an expansion of Minnesota law when it comes to accrual of the cause of action. In Dalton, the court noted, typically the cause of action accrues when there's an accident.
Right, the court basically said, one incident that causes
it's really unfair, because you may have a situation like in asbestos cases where you're not aware that you've been harmed until many years after the exposure. So they expanded Minnesota law and said, we're going to wait until you have knowledge of the injury and facts to put you on notice that your injury was caused by exposure to asbestos. And asbestos is the product that's at issue. And I would point the court not only to the Philippek case, which is Judge Doty's decision, which obviously isn't binding, but it interprets Dalton. But in Carjala itself, the court said, and this is the Eighth Circuit case that my friend relies on pages 160 and 161, it is when the disease manifests itself in a way which supplies some evidence of a causal relationship to the manufactured product. The manufactured product that's at issue in this case, that everyone is claiming in these cases is the defective product, is asbestos. And then in DeCoste, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1982 decision, now that case dealt with the accrual of the cause of action under the wrongful death statute of limitations, but the court talks about when the claim may have accrued when the individual was alive. And what the court said is, quote, and this is on page 49 of the decision, though the disease may have manifested itself some months before Napoleon DeCoste died, it apparently was never linked to asbestos or diagnosed as a mesothelioma. So what the court is saying there is the cause of action may have accrued if he knew his disease was caused by asbestos or if he had been diagnosed with mesothelioma before his death. Those are our facts. More than 6 years before this lawsuit was commenced, it is absolutely undisputed that this individual has had knowledge that he had two asbestos-related conditions, calcium deposits and mesothelioma. The district court correctly applied the law, correctly applied precedent, and we'd ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
I'd like to pick up on that, segue into that argument, Your Honors. The controlling decisional law here is Carjala and DeCoste. And we demonstrated, or I demonstrated in my, I respectfully submit in my recitation of the quote from Carjala earlier. Carjala is the foundation case here. It postdates the 1968 Supreme Court decision by several years and says, under Minnesota law, an instruction on the statute of limitations must be couched in terms of when damages resulted from the alleged breach of duty. That is, when a time could be brought, and they don't quote this part of that decision, when in time, or when that a claim could be brought in a court of law without dismissal for failure to state a claim. So you need to know who to sue, and you need to know what the tort is, and you need to know the liability. And that is ignored by the argument that counsel just made. Carjala is relied upon and cited by DeCoste, and that is the foundational decisional law, the precedential decisional law in terms of DeCoste, that applies here. But since DeCossi relies on Carjala and its analysis, the best place to go, we respectfully submit, is to Carjala itself. So we maintain that yes, there needs to be that objective point in time when there is a reasonable point of knowledge of the elements, all of the elements of the cause of action. And the Supreme Court of Minnesota said that last year in the Wallerink case, which we cite in our main brief. With regard to construction of Carjala, there's a decision that's not in our brief, but it is a frequently cited Illinois Supreme Court decision on statute of limitations that analyzes Carjala. It's Nolan, N-O-L-A-N, versus Johns Manville Asbestos. It's 421 Northeast 2nd, 864, and the pinpoint page is 868.
Is that cited in your brief?
I'm sorry. It is 421 Northeast 2nd, 864, with the pinpoint site being 868.
Is it cited in your brief?
It is not. And we can provide a 28, what we would call a 28G post-argument filing or whatever.
I have Westlaw, too.
It says, we are of the opinion that the preferred rule is that the cause of action accrues when the plaintiff knows or reasonably should know of an injury and also knows or reasonably should know that the injury was caused by the wrongful acts of another. And this is our point. And then among the cases cited
of
is
another
Carjala.
Or of the specific other now being sued.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Of another or of the specific defendant who has now been sued?
Of the wrongful acts of another. In other words, that's a phrasing. It's just of the other party, in other words. And applying Carjala, and before you can file a complaint, you need to know you've got to serve it on an individual. You got to know who it is. And you also have to know what the tort is. You have to know what the basis for liability is. And that's our point. There has to be this coalescence. And we think that the Foster versus Johns Manville decision, albeit decided under Iowa law, does express these principles very succinctly. With regard to the argument made by Walker Jamar counsel, Walker Jamar's carriers paid on this liability for years. There is an acknowledgement by them that the liability was incurred prior to dissolution. They've been paying Mr. Layton, who's a fine lawyer, for many years. Now, with regard to the 2007 amendment, I want to call the court's attention to it's a trial court decision in North Dakota. It's at main brief addendum pages 41 through 50.
The decision in this case, in the North Dakota case.
It's in a North Dakota, and not in Palmer, but relative to Walker Jamar. And it basically, among other things, relies on the 2007 amendment and says that it's not retroactive, it's prospective in the sense that the claim accrued after this claim accrued no earlier than December, January of 2011 or January 2012. See, my time has expired. But that particular decision, I think, capsulizes our argument that the new statute, may be relied upon prospectively as well as providing concrete interpretation of what the legislature intended rather than in Podvan, just where the court was reduced or subjected to having to infer. Thank you.
May I?
Oh, yes, one question.
I would simply like to acknowledge that it's my understanding that this very well may be Judge Shellhouse's last oral argument as a judge on this court. She has announced her retirement for later this fall. She has been an excellent jurist since 1996 when she was appointed to the district court bench in Hennepin County, was elected to two terms after that, and was appointed to this court in 2008. She has served the public and the bar very well. She is one of the most hardest working and smartest judges on the bench. I say this from my perspective as a public defender that appeared in front of her for years daily in Hennepin County and now having had the honor to serve with her on the Court of Appeals. On behalf of her colleagues on the Court of Appeals, I'd like to thank her for her service. She is a wonderful colleague. She has contributed tremendously to the work of this court. She is going to be missed by us and all of you. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And I'm sure she hated that.
I'll live. Thank you.
Thank you.